Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at Steinway & Sons and for the online music magazine, listenmusicculture.com. My guest today is writer, editor, novelist, and screenwriter Michael Iduff, whose fortunes as a writer dramatically changed for the better following the publication in 2005 of Bitter Brew, an article he penned for Slate.com about his failed business venture to launch a cafe in New York City. He spoke to me from his home in Berlin. Hey, Michael, thanks for having me over for tea. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I first read your work in a now famous Slate piece that you did about starting a cafe in New York that didn't work out. That led to a novel, which I would say is an expanded version of that piece, of that original
Expanded
piece.
And heavily fictionalized, yes.
But I would love to hear about that essay and how it led to these other projects and opportunities for you.
Right. Well, it's really weird because it's one of those life-changing things that's like seems small at the moment, but now that I can sort of like look at my life, it's absolutely like before and after that piece, which is crazy because everything else that happened to me after that, including moving to Russia and becoming an editor-in-chief of GQ in Russia and then turning that into a film career somehow and then like up to living in Berlin now and doing what I do, it's all really very easily and kind of linearly attributable to that piece. So yeah, you never know what can happen. In 2005, my wife Lily and I decided to experiment in a very small business and opened a tiny cafe. It existed for about nine months and then closed because it was obviously just going to pauperize us and also just ruin our marriage.
You threw in the coffee towel.
Exactly. And at the moment I was sort of struggling, I would say, journalist. I had my only gig at that point was at Pitchfork, which, you know, now it's like, hey, that's pretty good. But back then, Pitchfork was like, it was actually an interesting moment for Pitchfork. It was on its way to becoming, you know, a real medium, but essentially it was still this weird music blog ran by like a dude from Chicago, you know.
It was a blog in the corner. But yeah, music guys knew it, other guys
not so
much.
Yeah. Most importantly, it didn't pay. It was all volunteer work. So. And I would occasionally write little things for Slate. That was the apex of my career was Slate. So when we threw in the towel with the cafe, I thought that our experience would make for a funny kind of first-person essay for Slate. I pitched it, wrote it pretty quickly. It's short. It's like 1,200 words. They kept it for a while because it was deemed to be evergreen, which is, this kind of every freelance writer knows this limbo of having like a piece accepted somewhere and never knowing when it's going to run because it's evergreen.
Yes.
Right. I had a story at GQ gather dust for 14 months once. That was pretty brutal. I really needed them.
And you get paid upon publication.
Yes. Right. And with some lag after that as well. So anyway, we were completely broke and I was like really counting on even like the $500 from that Slate piece. But what happened was it came out on December 31st, 2005, right on New Year's Eve. So I was convinced that no one would read it. It's just going to, be completely overlooked in the New Year's hubbub. On January 1st, I, checked my email. Now it's January 1st, 2006. So back then you would still check your email like once a day,
Instead of every 7 minutes.
Yeah, or like just, when are you not checking your email, right?
Checking mine right now.
Exactly. So it was possible to be surprised by emails because you would, check it once a day. So I opened my email and there were literally 100 letters from readers. It just really struck a chord or a nerve or whatever. It's just a lot of people had this experience of like a disastrous cafe or small business ownership, and something about the piece really spoke to them. And among those emails, each and every one of which I insanely appreciated because it was like therapy at the moment, was an email from the famous director Nora Ephron, who said that she loved the piece, that she thought it could make for a nice book or even a movie, and she's going to forward the piece to her agent. And then, like, literally 2 days later, I had a literary agent. And, it's one of those things. It's like, you tell it, and it's like, yeah, it's kind of...
it's amazing.
Everyone thinks, like, that's what's going to happen, and I hate feeding everyone's illusions by saying, yes, it does happen. But like, because it's not like it was a genius piece. It really just landed in the right spot somehow. Because a lot of people who read Slate apparently also entertained this fantasy of owning a, you know, a nice little cafe.
And yours was a very wet blanket.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of people over the years... have thanked me for talking them out of starting a business. And
especially in New York City.
Well, the piece
all of Bleecker Street is empty at the moment.
Yeah, I've heard that there was like a, you know, I just to explain, I've been living outside of the United States for about 6 years now, but before that for almost 20 years I lived in New York. What I've heard was like there was this rash of little stores run by like Instagram powered stores, right? Like influencers selling like t-shirts with their famous hashtags or something like that, yeah, right?
This is real.
Is it still going
on? Well, it's like, remember when there were eBay stores?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
People would become sort of third-party agents for listing your stuff on eBay. It was really insane. And, you know, like you said, you don't know what's going to stick and what isn't.
Right. So. Yeah, exactly. So the piece was incredibly successful at Slate. I think it was one of their most read pieces ever, which, again, is just surprising because it's not about any of the sort of normal hot topics, yeah, right? It's not very controversial. It's just people kept discovering it and rediscovering it and using it as this kind of anti... Yeah, a demotivator in starting their own business. And I think I, you know, if I wanted to write a nonfiction book and then like travel some sort of like self-help circuit with it about my failure and what I've learned, I would probably be much wealthier than I am now, but probably much less creatively satisfied. So when you know, this whole agent thing started, because I had four or five agents contact me after the piece about turning it into a book. But I being, you know, at that point, like a, you know, pretentious little snot who saw it as my opening, because I always wanted to write a novel and no one would have it. So I was like, I'm just going to write a novel based on this. And as soon as most of the agents heard that I was going to make this fiction, that it was like, click, all right, not interested, you know, because everyone thought it would be some sort of like a self-help book. And Binky Urban, Nora Ephron's agent, was the only one who did not like blanch at the mention that I wanted to make this book fiction. She was like, all right, well, you know, I can sell 10 times more if it's nonfiction, right? I'm like, yeah, I know, but I really want to write a novel. I'm like, all right.
I'm glad you did.
Thank you. Yeah. But I don't know, it was always fun for me to kind of mix the real and unreal together. And even in the book, there are like real businesses and real New York streets in the book, but then they're kind of imperceptibly mixed in with the made-up stuff. For example, the cafe in the book, it's situated on a fictional street on the Lower East Side that's sandwiched between two real ones. It's like a fictional street between Orchard and Ludlow,
right,
that is not actually there, which is funny. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but when the book became a bestseller in Russia, which basically predetermined the rest of my life, people thought they could use it like Sex and the City, you know, like they could do like ground up tours of the Lower
Side,
and they were really, really, you know, frustrated that they couldn't find the street.
Why did it become a bestseller in Russia?
I don't know. I honestly don't. I mean, I'm being a little.
Did you write the translation? Did you?
Yes.
You did the Russian.
Yes.
So this might be an opportunity to explain that you're from Latvia and are fluent in a number of languages.
No, just the two.
Your German's okay.
No, my German's horrible.
All right. You fooled me at the cafe.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, my cafe German's all right.
Yeah, it's that expat cafe lexicon. We have that.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
I got you. All right.
But I'm sure the listeners have picked up on my accent. Yeah, I write and speak and think in English and Russian, sort of more or less kind of equally.
Okay, so you translated your own book into Russian.
Honestly, just for the bragging rights.
Right. I want to be like, I did. I have this in two languages. What's up?
Literally just to be like the guy, the second guy after Nabokov.
Yeah, Nabokov Jr. To
publish something in English and then have it self-translated into Russian. That was the only driving force, because there was no money in it or any kind of perspectives, because I really didn't think that it would happen in Russia. In fact, my agent, whom we've mentioned, when I was writing the book, she was like, you know, no one's gonna like this book outside of New York. Like, it's too, like, it's not even...
It's a very New York story.
Yeah. Like, you're writing it too New York-y. And, but ironically, you know, it did okay in the States. It got optioned by HBO, which was a whole different experience, because they wrote a pilot based on it, a TV pilot. And a few years later, after, you know, nothing happened and it was safe to do so, they showed me the pilot. And that was one of the most surreal experiences in my life, reading somebody's pilot based on my book. But they, like, they moved the action to San Francisco. And this being HBO, they just added a bunch of sex scenes.
Right.
And since the main characters are, like, based on, you know, myself and my wife, I was like, whoa! My God, that is some steamy stuff here.
Right. I feel like there's potential to do it sort of as a Bright Lights Big City without the drugs, or maybe with caffeine as the
hero main drug
in lieu of cocaine. Yeah. But that's another pilot we can work on another time. Okay, so this eventually led to a position. I got to hear about this with my one trip to St. Petersburg under my belt. You became the editor-in-chief at GQ Russia.
Yes, correct.
That sounds insane. Like, just hearing that position, knowing the state of journalism in Russia, such as I know it,
right?
It sounds like that must have been another surreal experience.
Well, it wasn't as bad. It was 2012, so this was in the Medvedev era, before Putin came back and sort of tightened all the screws. But yeah, I was very cognizant of the fact that, you know, the one American who came to Russia to edit a magazine before me ended up shot in 2004, right? Paul Klebnikov, who edited Forbes.
Thank you.
In Russia, yeah. But no, it was fine at the moment. What happened was, yeah, as I said, the book somehow like struck a chord with the Russian hipsters, and I now understand why, because partly it's because of this sort of limits on free speech and limits on self-expression, because a lot of young, cool, intelligent Russian men and women who normally would go into the creative field or politics or something like that, they actually go into sort of small kind of entrepreneurship. Yeah, so actually, when you know, you can't start a magazine, you know, on sort of unfettered, but you can start a coffee roasters, you know, or a barbershop. And it's a specifically kind of like a Moscow and St. Petersburg thing. But I think that I didn't even see that in this very New York story. I was actually writing something that would really resonate with my generation and actually the next generation, guys 10, 15 years younger than me, who were really interested in going into this kind of hipster business. So yes, so the book became kind of like a favorite in that crowd. And I suddenly ended up, you know, a more or less recognizable name in Russia, where I haven't really done anything, you know, in Russian for years and years before that. My family had moved to the United States in 92, and between 92 and 2010, I didn't really write in Russian, you know, or honestly even follow the news all that much.
Did you maintain a native speaker level of
efficiency? But mostly, yeah, but I mean, look, once the internet happened, it became much easier, you know. I would say that the years in real, like, wilderness Russia-wise were, like, 92 to 96, 97, when I just really broke off all connection. And then, obviously, once email happened, it was like, yeah, you just pick up, like, you start talking to your friends again. It's not easy to appreciate fully in our day and age, but in 92, when I was leaving, and, you know, I was 16, there was this definite feeling that, like, you're saying goodbye to everyone forever, because, like, when you're, you know, you're not, then you're never going to see your friends again. You're never going to, I mean, okay, maybe you're going to, like, exchange Christmas cards or something. We, did not realize that within 5 years of that moment, we could speak in real time. It's quite something, actually. It's another
big,
like,
shift. It's a big shift, millennials, that you'll never know about.
Yep. We're, we're the digital immigrants, actually, it's called, right? They're digital. So I'm doubly a digital immigrant. It's almost a pun. Anyway, the book became big in Russia, and I started publishing there, just journalism and kind of little stories of New York life and things like that. And then the Russian GQ, they have this like Man of the Year awards. All of a sudden I was like the writer of the year, and they got me in there. It was in 2010. And when their editor decided to leave, they sort of invited me to, you know, like, almost as an experiment to come over and try to take over. 2012 was a fascinating year to be in Russia, just to watch all the protests against Putin and the reaction to these protests and the Pussy Riot trial. What do you want the world to look like? What do you want it to be? Do you know that the wall has two sides and nobody is free? Did your mama come from Mexico? Papa come from Palestine? Sneaking all through Syria, crossing all the borderlines. Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again. And the way the whole thing kind of curdled into this new status quo for Russia that we're, you know, observing now. A lot of what Russia is now is directly attributable to, I think, the reaction to the 2012 protests, because the idea was like, oh, see, if we gave people a little democracy and a little freedom, this is what they do. They immediately like take to the streets protesting corruption. Then, like, why are we even bothering, you know? So I'm firmly convinced that the invasion of Ukraine and all the things that followed, they are a direct reaction to what the protesters of 2012 did. And a lot of these protesters were people I knew, because a lot of it was really driven by people from the media, so my colleagues, really. So I do feel kind of privileged to have been there at the time, even though it's ultimately a pretty sad tale.
And again, this real-life experience led to another book, Dressed Up for a Riot.
Yeah, I do tend to do that, yeah. Sorry, everyone.
No, but I'm saying, like, this is my life. This is probably a good formula for writers and budding writers out there. The old adage of write what you know. You're able to take that and build it into something larger. Sometimes fictionalized.
Right.
This one, not.
Yeah, no, so. There was no point fictionalizing it.
It was already crazy enough, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was just kind of I mean, 40 is a strange, you know, strange age to write a memoir, although, you know, I've seen memoirs by 20-year-olds these days, so I don't know. I tried to keep it to specifically the absurdity of running a fashion-forward magazine while, you know, half of my friends are, like, getting arrested at anti-government rallies. So that was the crux of the book. I can honestly say that the book didn't do too well because I think it tried to do two unrelated things at once. It tried to be like a breezy Condé Nast memoir, and at the same time function as a solid sort of primer on the sociological history of Russia's last decade. And it just, you know.
Are those two contrasting audiences?
I think so. I thought I was just being, you know, very clever here, like, by basically kind of sweetening the pill for people. But honestly, people who wanted, like, a splashy sort of media memoir were disappointed because there's literally, like, 20 pages about, you know, running a magazine. And then the people who wanted a serious sort of deep dive
were
into.
Were put off by the splashes.
Yeah, I think they were put off by, like, why are we reading about, you know, how he was running with some, like, glamorous people. So, commercially speaking, that was definitely a misfire. But at the same time, I'm very happy the book exists because it, you know, I got this amazing chance to write all of this down, and hopefully, you know, my potential grandkids would read it someday. So it's great to be able to just kind of put a little bow on your experience.
It's good to chronicle a chronicle.
Yeah,
you know, when
exactly.
You have that opportunity. Right. You write articles, you write books, you do some film work now as well. I'm wondering, what does your creative day look like? Is there a typical creative day for you, or is it just a varied patchwork experience?
Right. Well, unlike my book and journalism stuff, my film work is almost entirely done in collaboration with Lily, my wife. So that changes the dynamic tremendously. What we do is, like, when we come up with a story or a script idea, we just walk around and talk about it constantly for weeks, you know. And it's a funny process because to the untrained eye, it just looks like we're not really doing anything. We just sit around in cafes and walk around and talk, you know. We just kind of obsessively talk about something. And then when it comes time to actually sit down and write, we don't do the whole, like, George and Ira Gershwin thing of, like, one person at the keys and the other pacing around. We actually split up and we write sort of little bits and pieces and then kind of edit each other. Because I think it's almost, especially when we're talking about TV, it's almost impossible to conceive of a TV show alone. Because you really need to say everything that comes to your head out loud, if only to hear how stupid it sounds. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to have somebody who can be your sounding board and for whom you can be the sounding board. Hence the writer's rooms, you know? It's like, no one, unless you're, you know, Aaron Sorkin on, like, insane amounts of cocaine, can write, you know, a season of television alone. But
then sometimes it sounds like you did.
But... you gotta give me another chance.
At what?
At meeting the president.
You met the president last night?
I was wearing a bathrobe.
You sat in paint.
I was singing and dancing.
You were happy.
I threw my drink up in the air.
Yeah, but not that much of it landed on your head.
I looked like an idiot, and it's your fault.
How is it my fault?
You arranged the meeting over my express wishes.
I'm not the one who got you jumping around like Joey Heatherton.
You have to do something for me.
Arrange another introduction?
You have to arrange another introduction.
Last night you were scared to meet him.
And I'm still scared to meet him, but I'll overcome that in order to erase the humiliation that I've brought upon myself and my father.
You were just in your own little Euripides play over there, aren't you?
Please arrange another introduction.
Fine.
Really?
Yes.
Thank you.
So, yeah, so it's basically you brainstorm together, you write alone. If you're lucky enough to have a partner like I do, you edit each other and you come to some sort of compromise on everything. And that's what we've been doing. And lately, you know, we've been writing for this show called Deutschland 89. It's the third season of a famous spy series that started with the first season was called Deutschland 83. It's pretty successful all around the world.
The budget increased tremendously, you can see, in the second season.
Oh, in the second season when they go to Africa, yeah. Though not enough. They're pretty sore
still,
about
still
that.
Still German TV.
It's still German TV, but it's an international hit. It does amazingly well in the UK. You know, people watch it like it's the Game of Thrones in the UK. It's crazy. Ironically, the one country in the world where it's underperforming is, you guessed it, Germany. I think they kind of feel that it's like maybe it's too early or too flippant to use like Stasi and the sort of the Eastern German repressive apparatus as like the basis for what is essentially a pretty light adventure series, you know? So it rubs
it's,
a lot.
It's not enough like the Lives of Others.
I love The Lives
of Others. Yeah, me too. But I'm saying that's a very serious tone.
Yeah,
right?
But but you know that The Lives of Others came under a great deal of criticism in Germany because the director, whose name, unfortunately, it's Florian von Donnersmarck, but there's another name that I forgot because he's a German aristocrat with like an insanely long name. And that's part of the problem because when it came out, the reaction here was, what the hell is this, you know, West German fancy boy doing writing about East Germany where he's never lived? Yeah, he has never lived. So it actually came under the same kind of criticism. So it's funny that you've mentioned it. Anyway, so Lily and I are writing this now as part of a writer's room. So it's us and several more people. It's like in the circus or something. Like, you work on your act and you, like, workshop and like, cabarets, and then suddenly, like, you take your little, you know, couple act into like the big top when it's like, okay, so like there's horses there and there's the clowns and then like then you do your thing. So this is kind of how it feels like you've created your own little thing, but now it has to perform like in the service of a bigger thing,
right.
And it's been kind of a cool experience. Generally, we're obviously very lucky because I mean, as meet my cat Katsuka. Yeah, we're very lucky because honestly, there's like one good job if you're a screenwriter who writes in English in Berlin, and somehow Louis and I took it. So, I mean, but actually, I'm being flippant because there's more. I think more and more German producers are fine now working with English language writers, because mm-hmm. it's a huge paradigm shift.
It's a big market,
and you know, Netflix has come in and is changing the market quite a bit. They had, you know, after Deutschland 83, the next big hit was Dark, this time travel series that was huge on Netflix, and that's another fully German thing that you know, became famous worldwide.
Babylon Berlin
mm-hmm. starring the female lead from Lily and Mine, Russian series, okay. The Optimist.
She's tremendous.
Yeah, Severia. Talk about difficult names. Her name is Severia Januszauskaite. I know, right? She's Lithuanian, yeah, but she's a tremendous actress. I'm dying to work with her again. She's got this whole, like, kind of 40s Hitchcock blonde thing going, and I heavily recommend everyone to check out whatever she's in.
Yeah, very strong, a strong presence and an intriguing presence.
Yeah.
And in a show with many intriguing presences, she still manages to stand out.
And she did this song that I really love. You know, I think it's called Suasha to Shtau, which has become kind of a niche hit. It's on the soundtrack to Babylon Berlin, and there's a great video for it. So she's a good singer as well.
Suasha to Shtau. Dem Licht geraubt, doch noch nicht jetzt. Wunde warten bis zuletzt. Ozean der Zeit, ewiges Gesetz. Zu Asche. Doch noch nicht jetzt.
This sounds lovely, being able to, I mean, as a writer who does not work collaboratively, I feel like historically it's very easy to let yourself down, but it's hard to let other people down. I could imagine really enjoying a collaboration with writing.
I get a lot of this, you know, especially now that I said, like, okay, running a cafe together, you know, almost like destroyed us as a couple within like half a year. So how the hell are we like writing together for like the last 5 years? And honestly, it's just, I think that the difference is that this is something we're good at and running the cafe wasn't. That's number one. And the second thing is, I think we've been together for long enough before we started doing that it's almost kind of a natural outcome of us having been together for like over 15 years, you know. If we started dating as like me a screenwriter and Lily a screenwriter, I seriously doubt that it would immediately like lead to a collaboration. In fact, I think we would just be competitive as hell, and you know how it is. So yeah, so I think it really helped that we did other things for years before sort of coming together to do this one.
For younger aspiring writers out there, hustling freelancers, do you have any advice apart from get a call from Nora Ephron when you write a piece, which right. unfortunately she is no longer with us?
Yeah, I mean, if you can't find your, you know, Nora Ephron, look, I mean, in a way it's easier now because it's all a giant meritocracy and you can just kind of throw your stuff out there, and if it's original enough, I mean, you can, you know, on the one hand, yeah, it's such a horrible wall of noise, right? And it's hard to get through it. On the other hand, you can get famous off a tweet. Like, it's like you don't even have to write a Slate piece. Like, so it's a weird world when you just, it feels like it's harder than ever to get this kind of an institutional type of chance, like to get a call from some grizzled like eminence, like get it, like, you know, just this is Graydon Carter or whatever on the phone, like, you know, come work with me, like, you know, it's like that model is all but dead. Maybe you do the best, but then on the other hand, like the sort of the amount of times you get to play this lottery has increased millionfold, because you play this lottery every time you put something out. Like, you never know what's gonna work. And, you know, if you look at your timeline in any kind of social network, it's like half of it is going to be filled with people sharing content by people you are hearing for the first time in your life about. And so, like, every moment someone's getting a break. Like, the breaks themselves no longer mean that, okay, you're going to get like, you know, a cushy media job for the next 20 years. That's true. That was an aberration. And I think the sooner we forget that this was like that, the better. Like, honestly, like even, you know, living in Moscow, there were days where like just being, you know, a correspondent for some magazine or newspaper in Moscow, like meant a free apartment, a private driver, and all those insane perks that if you think about, like no one really needs, you know, all you need is just working knowledge of where you're at, which ironically, a lot of these correspondents didn't have. Like they literally would go and like do interviews through an interpreter. So yeah, so that whole model, like the cushy media job model is dead, but in the end, what you've got instead is this kind of a crazy hustle that could, like, where you can just strike gold at any moment. You just have to keep yourself open to kind of to the fact that it can happen in any format. That's kind of the crazy thing. And increasingly, you know, like a young person's game for sure. We talked about this before the interview. Like, I'm 42. I'm finally starting to feel that, okay, there are things that I probably cannot, like I cannot write a script to a computer game. Like I don't know where to, you know, like some things like that. It was like, because I used to spend years thinking of myself as like this universal soldier media wise, but it's like, all right, there are things I can't quite do. Like I can't, you know, grab like a GoPro and do like a Vice style like video piece. I mean, maybe I can, but it's just, I'm not going to be great at it. Yes. Like, yeah, exactly. So like, you know, you have to realize like, okay, these are the things I can do. These are the things I can't. So things I can do, like, let me just like apply myself fully to those.
Tremendous advice.
A little long. Here's more advice. Be shorter than me. More concise.
That's it though. There's a lot of noise, but there aren't as many gatekeepers.
Yes.
There are, but you can bypass them. You can go straight to the people and see what happens.
And I think that this is going to sound weird, but I think our notion, like our idea of what it means to get paid is also different. Like younger people, you know, here's another way I'm like clearly showing my age. I have like a bizarre prejudice against crowdfunding. Like I don't like crowdfunding. And I only recently realized that this must be generational because, you know, people younger than me, like they think of nothing of just like, here's my Patreon, Venmo me this. It's absolutely fine. It's just a part of like you go through life choosing what projects and what names to support monetarily. And this is actually a pretty cool way of doing things, both as a creator and as a consumer. I think that the more we get into this, the less stigma there will be in the whole notion of like, you like my stuff, throw some money my way. And it might work very well, actually. Might work better than, you know, the 20,000 a year entry-level media jobs where I've spent like the first 10 years of my New York life, you know.
Thank you very much for speaking with me today. And I look forward to reading and seeing more from you.
Definitely.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Pussy Riot's Make America Great Again, from a Season 2 episode of the American television show West Wing, and from the song Zu Asche, Zu Staub, featured in the German television show Babylon Berlin. Our intro and outro music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, performed on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at listenmusicculture.com. Questions for the podcast can be sent to info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Thank you for listening.